In 1945, the disappearances began.
In 1974, police arrest a man walking in the street naked and covered in blood.
I'm Jennifer Coffeen.
And I'm Fraser Coffeen.
And this is Creepy History.
All right, welcome back to Creepy History.
Hello.
We are happy to have you here. We hope that you all had a great Halloween.
Yeah. I hope you had a spooky Halloween.
A spooky Halloween. We hope your decorations are down. Right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You got to take them down.
I know. I hope that you got the good candy bars.
Like not like the ones with the razor blades in them or things like that.
Or raisins.
Those are the two things you want to avoid on Halloween. Razor bug, candy bars, and raisins.
That's right.
Equally terrible as a kid.
I'm really excited about my story tonight because I feel like I'm just in such a spooky mood. And I feel like something about this time of year, even like post-Halloween, there's something about sort of like late fall, moving into winter, that's just, I don't know, it's kind of creepy and eerie. And
sure, absolutely.
You know, yeah.
Eerie Thanksgiving season.
That's ooh. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, you ready to jump in?
Yeah, I'm excited for my story as well. I'm excited to tell you all about it.
I want to hear about this drink.
Okay.
It's very blue.
Yeah, so as always, pictures up on our Instagram, yep. So take a look at it. It is super blue.
It's really blue. And it's like the color of, what would you even say?
Like
Cookie Monster.
Yeah.
It's Cookie Monster blue.
Sure, sure. It's very blue. It's
and
a Cookie Monster
smells
blue.
Smells like spring break.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It is called, you ready for this?
I'm ready.
The Exorcist.
Oh, nice!
Now, our faithful listeners may recall that we did a show on The Exorcist in the past, and so you may be saying, why didn't we drink it then?
Right.
That's because it was Jen's story, and I always make the cocktail.
Yeah, you didn't know.
Right, I'm the cocktail maker, and I don't know what Jen's story is until showtime, so the story is always kind of based on my... Or the cocktail's always kind of based on my story.
Did it feel like a lost opportunity to you? Or had you not yet heard of this cocktail?
I hadn't yet heard of this.
Okay,
I searched for it. And that, you know, that gives you a little tiny spoiler about my episode to come. But that's all right. So yeah, it's called The Exorcist.
All right.
I'm not going to tell you what's in it just yet.
Ooh.
Because I want to... I've never had this before. I'm curious to take a sip and then get your thoughts.
And then you're going to tell me what's in it?
And then I'll tell you what's in it. Okay, so cheers.
Cheers. Is it embalming fluid?
It's pretty intense looking. All right, let's do this.
It's not terrible. I thought it was going to taste worse.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to taste, like, stronger. I guess I was thinking it was going to taste like formaldehyde.
That's but, the color gets you.
Yeah, it's like, so there is tequila in it. I can smell it.
For sure.
But it's not, you don't get that strong tequila bite.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's got a lime in it, but the lime is really nice.
Yeah.
So what's the blue?
Okay, so here's the weird thing. This is three ingredients. You've
okay.
identified two of them.
Hey,
tequila
look
and lime.
Look
at you.
That,
I know.
Look at that palate.
You're doing great. Very impressive. You did also watch me make it.
That's
but you
fair.
Don't pay a lot of attention when I'm making it.
No,
so.
I don't pay attention to anything.
Yeah, so here we go. So, okay, so it is tequila and lime. The third ingredient is where the blue comes from. It's blue curacao. So, blue curacao is like a blue liqueur that's basically the same thing as triple sec. It's just blue.
Oh.
So, like, this is margarita, is what we're dealing with
yeah,
here.
Yeah, it kind of has that taste. But
it's because it's slightly different ratios.
But here's the interesting
but that's
thing.
That's the same ingredients.
It doesn't even have, because I feel like margarita has more of a tequila bite.
Yes.
This one seems to even have less.
There's more lime juice than you typically would have
okay.
in a
I'm
margarita.
Try it again. Yeah, I like it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's you know,
the blue curacao doesn't seem to have a taste though. Or maybe it just mixes with everything else.
It's just mixed. It's like if you try it again, it's got a vaguely orangey taste to
okay.
it.
Okay. So which just kind of adds to it.
Sure.
I like this.
Yeah.
It's not bad.
It's good.
All
it's,
right.
It's pretty bold looking. It's certainly good for Halloween parties.
It really is.
I assumed that The Exorcist as a cocktail was some sort of like joke gag thing that like,
sure.
you know, one person one time made. But like, I found a fair number of references to it on like various websites. I did not find any, I don't think it's in like the Difford's Guide. I don't think it's like an official cocktail. But I found I saw it repeated on enough sites that I was like, okay, I think that this has, like, taken off as a legitimate thing.
It's a great Halloween cocktail.
I mean, the color of it is
Makes fantastic. It very fun, but it's not so disgusting.
No.
That it's, you know what I mean? Like, what is usually this color is something that's going to make you very ill the next day.
Well, and so it's funny, because I have not had a blue cocktail in quite some time. Yeah, because there was once upon a time that I did have too many blue cocktails in a single night, and that was the end of that for many a year.
What was the cocktail?
I don't know. Was it Everclear thing.
Everclear in it?
Was it probably Everclear? Everclear and blue curacao, to be honest with you.
Okay, so I was at a bar.
Oh, it probably was. I bet it was Everclear and some sort of blue Kool-Aid. That's probably what it was. Now, as I look back in retrospect, that's probably
it. As soon as you said it, I could taste it. Like, I know what that tastes like, that Everclear Kool-Aid taste.
Yeah, in one of those, big jugs normally have, like, water in at a soccer game.
For sure. Ugh. So one time I was at this bar many, many years ago, and they had, like, a bunch of shots, like, colorful shots in those, like, what do you call them, the little beaker?
Test tube.
Yeah, a test tube. That's what I was looking for. In a test tube. And it was this pucker. Remember the apple pucker?
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
But it was all different flavors of it. And so it reminds me of that, because it was, like, those really, really, like, you know, acid-y colors, like green and blue and purple and pink. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, it's a lot. A lot to deal with.
No, if you ever see that, don't drink it. No.
But yes, but I'm surprised because I assume that this is going to be some sort of sickly,
that's
sweet,
exactly
horrible
what I thought.
Thing.
I was like, Fraser, come on. We've really...
Yeah, we're not 20. Yeah. 21. Like, we're not 21.
Yeah, 21, exactly. What are we... But it's nice, and I would totally... We should absolutely keep this for parties.
But people will be so... They'll be like, what the hell are
they'll
you serving me?
They'll be scared, and then we'll have to
They'll be appalled that we're giving them a drink that looks like this.
Yeah.
What are we going to do with our giant bottle of blue curacao now?
We're going to have parties someday and make this.
Awesome.
There's got to be other drinks.
Oh, there are plenty, but they're going to be blue.
Please send us your blue curacao recipes.
Yes, indeed.
Blue curacao breads.
Oh, no. No, not at all.
All right. Are we ready? Are we ready? Yeah. I feel like this drink actually goes really well with my story.
Oh, good.
Just because it feels like cold and sort of like woodsy. I don't know.
Nice. All right.
It's kind of
cold and woodsy. I feel like it feels like a...
Not woodsy, maybe, but...
To me, it feels like a drink that is like, if we're watching The Reanimator, we should be drinking this.
For sure.
All right. Shout out to The Reanimator. Great film.
Okay. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay. I am tonight doing The Disappearances at Bennington Triangle.
Ooh.
Do you know anything about Bennington Triangle?
I don't. It sounds... Okay. The Disappearances at Bennington Triangle. I've never heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds to me like it's like a Sci-Fi Channel knockoff of a Bermuda Triangle movie.
Okay, that's fair. It does sound like, because everyone knows Bermuda Triangle,
of course.
Right? Ships go missing, planes go missing. We all know that. Bennington Triangle is here's the thing. I knew some of these stories. I just didn't realize that they were all in this one place.
Wow. In the Bennington Triangle.
In the Bennington Triangle. Uh-huh. I didn't realize that was the name of it. And I want to give a shout out to Meg Groves for sending me this amazing TikTok, which talks about the Bennington Triangle, which is where I got this idea from. Because I was like, I know some of these stories. And then I was like, oh, I didn't realize it was like all... Anyway, it's way creepier than I had thought.
Nice.
So, okay.
And from TikTok. There you go.
Meg Gross sent me a tweet from TikTok.
Do you send tweets from TikTok?
It's like a screen share thing or something. I don't know.
You sounded hipper before you started saying the tweet.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, boy. It fell apart. It came through the MySpace.
I also... Disappearances really bother me.
Sure.
Just the idea of just, like, no information whatsoever. I think maybe I've traveled quite a lot on my own. I still do sometimes, like, you know, and I just, I'm like, what if I'm just vanished?
You've done a lot of disappearances for our episodes here.
It's my jam. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, jumping into the story. Okay. Bennington Triangle.
Ready.
So Bennington is an area that is, it's basically the town of Glastonbury, which is in Bennington County, Vermont.
Okay.
So we're in Vermont. Okay.
Got it.
Glastonbury is a ghost town. It was, let me see, I'll get to it in a minute. Okay, I have more info on that. All right, it is said to be a cursed area. There have been from, you know, decades past, there's reports of UFOs, there's Bigfoot sightings, there's reports of, like, weird noises and strange creepy lights and, like, all this kind of stuff. And this has been going on for a really long time.
Okay.
Native Americans long avoided the area. They spoke of a legend that warned of a stone in the mountains that would open up and swallow anyone who stepped on it.
Ooh, that's awesome.
That is so horrifying.
That's amazing. Right?
That's like one of my fears of just like slipping down a tiny opening and like falling a long ways, which is like a dream that I have. That's basically it, right? Just the ground just opens up and it's like shoop and you're gone. So the name the Bennington Triangle was coined by a Vermont author, Joseph A. Citro. He was known, oh, so good, as the Bard of the Bazaar.
Oh, man.
And the Ghost Master General.
Oh, how do I get to be known as the Bard of the Bazaar?
I want to be the Ghost Master General.
Well, we can share.
All right, sweet. He's still alive. He's sort of the main person, you know, in that area. He documents all the folklore, the hauntings, the ghost stories, the paranormal stories, and the occult happenings in New England. I'm going to give a shout out to him. His books include Green Mountain Ghosts, Ghouls and Unsolved Mysteries, and Damned Yankees, Cursed in New England.
Nice.
Yeah, I know. I gotta look this guy up. I bet he does talks and stuff around, and I would like to participate in that. Okay, so just to give you a little background on Glastonbury and like the Bennington County area. So most of the town is in the Green Mountain National Forest. Okay, so it's very, it's very foresty. Like there's, you know, it's not very populated at all. The highest point in the town is Glastonbury Mountain. The Long Trail and the Appalachian Trail both sort of go through there. And it was once a logging community, a small logging community. So that's kind of the time that it became populated. It was abandoned at the end of the 19th century and became a ghost town. The population in 2010, guess what it was?
4,000.
Eight.
Oh, nice.
Eight people in 2010 lived there.
Good stuff.
Are you living there? I mean, it's like how...
Yeah, that's not a lot of people.
Remember when we went to Wyoming and there was that sign that... What was it? It started with a B.
I can't remember.
Town and it was like four?
I thought it was three.
It was three?
I think it was population of three.
Yeah, I was like, wow.
Yeah, what is that? Yeah.
Anyway, okay.
Incredible.
So eight people live in there in 2010. It's one of the two Vermont towns, along with Somerset, there. The populations have dropped so low that the town is now considered unincorporated. That means it doesn't have a local government, and the town's affairs are handled by a state-appointed supervisor. So basically...
I think those town's affairs are handled by the eight people who live there, and their guns, and that's probably how they handle it.
That's true. Okay. So that gives you a little, just to give you a little background on what's going on in this town. So starting in the early 1800s, there were sightings of a Bigfoot-type creature in the Glastonbury Mountains, in the Green Mountains. And this became known as the Bennington Monster. Yeah. One of the first sightings was when a stagecoach full of passengers was forced to stop because the road was like washed out.
Okay.
So they had to stop. The driver notices... like really large footprints in the mud, and he's like, those are too large to be a human. The coach is then attacked by a large creature who knocks the vehicle onto its side, so all the passengers inside are like screaming and freaking out, and then they look out and they can see a pair of eyes and then like this sort of like monster giant beast thing like roar and like run off into the forest, and they describe it as a large hairy animal standing over 6 feet tall, but like standing up on like legs.
Okay.
Yeah. So there have long been stories of people going missing into the area. In 1943, a man named Carol Herrick was hunting and went missing during the trip. And he was about 10 miles northeast of Glastonbury. So he was in the woods. The body was discovered 3 days later. It was surrounded by like gigantic footprints. And he had been squeezed to death.
Squeezed to death?
Yeah, that's what it says.
Wow, okay.
Now you're like, does that mean strangled? Was his whole body squeezed?
I don't know. Way more details about squeezed to death.
I don't know.
Is that what's officially like on the coroner's report?
I have no idea, but that's what I read.
Dang, okay.
So, okay. So now we're going to jump ahead to a couple years later in 1945. There is a 5-year span in the Bennington Triangle where 5 different people disappear.
Okay.
You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. It's pretty spooky. From 1945 to 1950.
I'm ready.
So, November 12th, 1945, a 74-year-old man named Matty Rivers is working as a guide for hunters in Glastonbury. So he takes people into the woods. He's like their guide. You know, he shows them like the hunting spots, shows them around, you know, helping them get in.
Sure.
And out. So he knows the area very well. He is working with a party of four hunters, and he takes them around the area of something called Hell Hollow, which, I mean, you're just like, you should, I don't know what's going on. You should not be over there.
Don't hunt in Hell Hollow. Don't
stay away from Hell Hollow. It's in the southwest woods of Glastonbury, and then he is just lost. Like, he's leading them, and then he just is not seen anymore.
But he went into Hell Hollow.
Yeah. 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 So it's not even like he wandered off from the group.
He's just gone.
Or like, yeah, he was the leader and they're all following him and then he's just gone.
Oh man. Okay.
Yep. And so they search for him, you know, for quite some time. They feel, you know, he's very knowledgeable. He knows the area really well. You know, he's been in there many times. So they're just kind of, they basically just kind of assume that like he, you know, he lost his way or whatever and he'll find his way back out. So, but he never surfaces. More than 300 locals and the U.S. Army soldiers go, they leave from Massachusetts Fort Devens and they sort of form a search party and they comb through the wilderness for 8 days. They turn up nothing.
Wow.
No body, no supplies left behind.
But the other hunters are all fine.
Everybody else is fine.
Crazy.
Nothing. They don't find anything
okay.
about them. So that's it. That's the end of that.
And there's nothing, never further follow-up. Never seen
again. Nobody ever found anything again. Okay,
all right.
All right. So 1 year later,
okay.
almost exactly to the day. It's now, that was November 12th, and this is December 1st, 1946. This is probably the most famous
okay.
known disappearance. This is the one that I knew. Paula Weldon is an 18-year-old student at Bennington College. It's Thanksgiving break. She decides to stay behind at the college. She doesn't go home for the holidays.
Okay.
And so she's there with, like, you know, there's handfuls of other people who are kind of there or whatever.
Sure.
And just, like, hanging out during break.
Which, P.S., is the setup for Black Christmas, the saying.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Paula Jean, her name was Paula Jean Weldon. She worked at the school's dining hall. So she was still working that day. She did a double shift. Then she goes back to her dormitory. She changes. So her roommate was there as well. So her roommate sees her. She changes into a red coat, sneakers, and jeans. And then she tells her roommate, whose name is Elizabeth Johnson, that she's heading out to take a long walk. So she's going to go hike through the woods. This is something that she did.
Sure.
You know, a lot of people yep. did or whatever. And Weldon leaves around 2:45 that afternoon. She is seen hiking by many people. So she is seen by a newspaper employee who she stops and speaks to for a few minutes. He actually gives her directions. She's later seen in the woods by an elderly couple who are hiking like the entire time about 100 yards behind her. So they see her go in. They're kind of just, you know, I mean, we've been hiking,
yeah,
right? So you
sure.
just like there's like people ahead of you and occasionally you sort of catch up to them a little bit. You fall back,
right,
that
right.
kind of thing. So there's this elderly couple that's basically hiking just like right behind her. According to this couple, Paula turns a corner in the trail and then in a few sort of minutes, they reach the same corner and she's just gone. She's disappeared. Paula never shows up for her Monday classes. So this is Saturday, I think, right? Did I say that?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, or maybe the next day, I'm not sure. Maybe it was Sunday, but she doesn't show up for Monday classes.
Okay.
And this sort of is the spark that sends off the search.
Right, right.
So, and it's a massive search. This is an 18-year-old. She's a college student. Everybody's back now from break. So there's a search party of more than 1,000 people, and they put out a reward of $5,000, which is quite significant.
Sure.
For 1946. The disappearance becomes a huge news story at the time. They call her, parents, I think it was just her father. Oh yeah, we get to that. So, and you know, they come in, like, you know, of course they're doing everything they can to bring attention to it, to get, you know, a lot of people coming in to search.
Right.
There's a massive turnout of people coming in to help. They get aircrafts, you know, a lot of law enforcement's come to help out, a group of hikers. They say that they've seen a girl who matches Paula's description on the long trail, which is a 270-mile
okay.
long trail.
Yep, yep. It's got a name. Yep.
So they claim that they see her on this trail, which is different from where she had originally started hiking from.
Okay.
Kind of, I guess it's sort of nearby. A driver comes forward and he claims that he picked up a hitchhiker that matches her description, but really these don't really pan out into anything.
Okay, got it.
There's no really follow up after that, you know? And I mean, and as we know now, like people see other people that they think looks like the missing person. Like it happens all the time, but there's no proof that it was any of it was ever her. Or there was, you know, nothing ever found. Weldon's father, he's very vocal about criticizing the authorities and the people running the search. He says there's like, you know, they're not using sophisticated methods to handle it. He sort of really goes after the Vermont State Police. And, this kind of was what kicks off them forming the Vermont State Police. So they don't really have a set police force in this area at that time.
Okay.
In 1946. So that actually like kind of helps create it. The case remains open to this day. They never find her.
Nothing.
They never find anything. Wow. They don't find a body. They don't find clothes. They don't find items. They find
just nothing.
Nothing.
Man.
And they don't, other than those two people who say that one of them saw her on a similar trail and one of them like said that she was hitchhiking. So I think at the time there was a lot of speculation, as always, of course, when women go missing, we're like, she ran off to go see a boyfriend.
Yeah, right, of course.
You know, she ran away from home. But it's like, there's just, her father's like, she didn't have any money.
Yeah.
Like her roommate was like, all I saw, she just had a jacket on and that was it. Like she wasn't upset. She didn't have a boyfriend who lived far away. Like, you know, this is not the age of the internet where you could have possibly met somebody.
Right. Yeah.
Like it just wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
And she was just hiking and she just disappeared.
Wow.
That's it.
Okay.
The disappearance of Paula Jean Weldon also catches the attention of Shirley Jackson.
Hey, Jen works Shirley Jackson.
Best friend.
Everybody take a shot.
And writer. Shirley Jackson was living in North Bennington, Vermont at that time. Her husband, Stanley Hyman, worked at Bennington College at the time that Paula Jean goes missing.
Okay. Yep.
Shirley Jackson was very affected by this case. It becomes the inspiration for her second novel, Hangzaman, as well as lesser known, because a lot of people know that was her second novel is sort of based off of this. And then she also wrote a short story called The Missing Girl.
Which is
inspired by this. And that short story is really creepy. And it's just really about, it's about a girl, I think she's younger. I think she's only like 13 or 14 or something. It was a summer camp.
Okay.
And she's like, I'm going to take a walk. And her roommate's like, whatever. And then they don't realize she's gone for like a really long time. And then when they do, it's like this whole thing of like, nobody remembers her being in any of these, like, you know, in any of the camp activities. They don't remember she was here. They don't remember. And then it's sort of the end. It's like, did this girl even exist? Like the parents kind of are muddy about when she, I don't know. It's really, really upsetting.
That's cool. Okay.
And so it's interesting to me because, you know, I don't know the length of time between when Paula disappeared and when the search was like, you know, no, like when it started, like did her roommate not say anything when she didn't come back? Did it take a couple days? I don't know. But like, anyway,
interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So it was a huge deal.
Sure.
You know, anyway. Okay. So exactly three. So that's Paula Weldon, Paula Jean. 3 years to the day that Paula Jean Weldon disappears, the Bennington Triangle sees yet another disappearance, probably the most creepy supernatural of them.
All right.
All right. So we have 68-year-old James Tedford. He boards a bus to Bennington. He's in St. Albans, Vermont. He's visiting friends or relatives there, and then he gets on a bus to go to Bennington. So there are many, many eyewitnesses on this bus, including the driver.
Okay.
They all claim the same thing. They say Tedford gets into his seat, you know, when they leave St. Albans. He stays in it the entire time. He's basically in that seat all the way up until the last stop before Bennington.
Uh-huh.
And then the bus pulls into Bennington, and he's gone.
What?
He's just gone.
Just not in the bus?
He's not in the bus anymore.
Oh, man.
So they claim, a bus, you know, with many people in it, and the driver claim that the last stop before Bennington, he's in his seat.
He is there.
He's there. They pull in at Bennington. He doesn't get off the bus. Nobody sees him. He's never seen again.
Wow.
Nothing.
Wow.
Gone. So
super X-Files.
Yeah. And then, okay, there's more creepy parts of this. So, you know, there's like, of course, I'm sure the police are like, I'm sure he didn't vanish into thin air, like inside of, you know.
Right. Obviously. Yeah.
But everyone's very baffled. Like his luggage is still there on the bus. he has a timetable, like a bus timetable, open on his seat. So just like sitting there. And that's it. There's nothing else.
Wow.
And the witnesses claim that he must have disappeared while the bus was traveling down Route 7, which goes right through the Bennington Triangle.
And that's it.
That's it. They nip no body, no wow. other evidence. The luggage is never claimed.
Yeah. And there's never any further follow-up. And there's
nothing else. They never find anything. Okay. They don't find, again, the same with everybody else. They don't find clothing.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't find that, you know, there's no sightings. Nothing.
Wow.
Gone.
That's a good one.
A year later, in mid-October of 1950, 8-year-old Paul Jepson is with his mother. She takes him in the family pickup truck to go... So it says she goes to the dump to tend to the pigs.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. I don't know what was going on there.
But she's doing something. She's doing running something. An errand.
Okay. She's running an errand to the dump to give the pigs whatever. Some food.
Doing something.
Something. She and her husband are caretakers of either the dump or the pigs.
Something like
or
that.
Or both.
Okay.
So she's going there to do this. She brings her 8-year-old. He's hanging out. So she basically, she's not with him at that time. She sort of is like, you know, a bit away, like out of sight of him, like dealing with the pigs or whatever.
Sure.
And she comes back and he's gone.
Ugh.
Like no trace of him. Hundreds of people get together for a search party. The New Hampshire sheriff brings in a bloodhound to sniff out, you know, the boy. The dog picks up a scent, but loses it at like, sort of a nearby crossroad, which many people thought was perhaps like he had been picked up by a motorist.
Okay.
Like somebody driving. In case you didn't know what motorist
Thank meant. You. Yeah, appreciate it. That's good.
Old-timey word. So it goes on for a long time. They find nothing.
Same thing.
Same thing. They don't find a body. They don't find any clues. They mm-hmm. don't. They find nothing. Many people start to look at the parents, look at the mother. There's some newspaper articles about possibly that, like, insinuating that he was fed to the pigs.
Whoa,
that
just geez. Seems
mean and That's out a lot. Of control. Yeah, but basically... the boy's father tells the Albany Times Union that the lure of the mountains pulled in his missing son, and the boy had talked of nothing else for days prior to the disappearance.
Oh, okay.
Been talking about the mountains.
And the going mountains, to the mountains.
Mountains took him.
Oh, geez. Okay. All right.
Here we go. This is our last one.
Man, these are amazing.
2 weeks after this.
Okay.
Okay. So Paul Jepson disappears in October, mid-October, 2 weeks later. So it must have been like the very beginning of November, which is about the same time that,
the other people.
Yeah. Cause no,
it's all like November, December.
Maddie here. Rivers was November 12th. Yeah. Right. So they're all the same time of year. Yeah. That's the other thing that's really eerie. About 2 weeks later, 53-year-old Frida Langer, she is an experienced hiker mm-hmm. and a survivalist. She's very familiar with the area. She spends a lot of time in there, spends a lot of time hiking. She is on a trip with her cousin, and her cousin and her husband, and they're like camping out. So, they're basically on the Somerset area of the Long Trail, which borders East Glastonbury.
We talked about the Long Trail before.
Correct. So, all these are sort of happening in a very similar area, which is like why the triangle.
Yeah, right.
So Frida and Herbert, her cousin, they go for a hike. They're about a half a mile into the hike, and Frida falls into a stream, and she's, like, wet or whatever. So she's like, hey, I'm going to go back to camp. I'm going to change my clothes. It's just a half mile back, and then I'll just come right back and meet you, and we'll finish our hike, right? So she goes a very short distance.
Uh-huh.
Her husband actually was still there because I guess he had hurt his knee or something, and he was, like, you know, like, still hanging out at the camp. The husband never sees her. She never gets back to camp. The cousin never sees her again.
Wow.
In between this half mile between the cousin and the husband. Just disappears again. Just gone.
Okay.
And in an area that she knew very well.
Yeah.
Never returns. Helicopters from the Connecticut Coast Guard and the Army in Massachusetts, they search the area. 400 people, including the National Guard, search the area.
Uh-huh.
They find nothing. Oh, 6 months later, the only time they find a body.
Oh, okay.
Here we go. So 6 months after she goes missing, Frida Langer's corpse is found near the Somerset Reservoir. It's an area, a very open area that had been searched many, many times.
They searched it a whole bunch.
They had searched it a whole bunch. They found nothing. 6 months later, a body shows up.
Oh, wow.
But even with the body, there's no cause of death that can be determined. The body is decayed very badly.
Sure.
And that's it. They can't find any other clues. They don't have any other ideas. That's it. They know nothing.
That's it? That's the end of the story?
That's the end of
the story. Oh, my gosh. Wow.
A whole bunch of people disappeared.
Wow.
So, many people, you know, obviously the theories are things like, you know, they're abducted by UFOs. They're taken by creatures.
Yeah.
There's possibly a serial killer. They were abducted by, like, different motorists.
Yeah.
But the serial killer thing is a little, like, you know, it's different ages and, like, types of people.
Sure.
You know, but I mean, you know, it doesn't have to fall into that thing, but a lot of times it does. It's ghosts.
That's the crazy.
Swallowing you up.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
Pretty nuts.
So one interesting thing I was thinking, it's Glastonbury is the area there, right?
Uh-huh.
So in Twin Peaks, Glastonbury Grove is the name of the place in the woods where you access the Black Lodge. And Glastonbury is also, you know, it plays a role in, like, Arthurian lore.
Sure.
So I think I've always assumed that Glastonbury Grove in Twin Peaks was named after that. But this makes more sense.
Yeah, I bet it was totally after this.
I wonder if it was.
Yeah.
That's
or at least he must have known. You know what I mean? At least, like, a nod to it.
This certainly fits more with how
that, like,
area is in Twin Peaks.
The disappear, you know, just the complete vanishing.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
And then there's just nothing found.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Very creepy.
Wow, that's a super creepy story.
Yeah, a couple of things that I researched was Bustle, Wikipedia, Legends of America, Ranker. Yeah.
There you go.
The info from.
And TikTok.
And TikTok.
There you go.
Yeah.
Awesome. Good. Wow.
Yeah. If you kind of just Google it, like, you'll see it's similar with the Bermuda Triangle where, I mean, it's just this one, like, all these disappearances happen in this one specific area, which is kind of like triangular.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, it's all in this one, like, small area.
Yeah. Just all contained in there.
Mountains. I mean, it is mountains and I feel like, you know, really just, you know, remote, dense.
Sure.
Like, so, I mean, I do feel like people get lost in stuff like that all the time.
Well, and especially ones
animals,
like,
and
yeah.
I mean, it's also the time of year where it probably is getting very, very cold at night.
Yeah.
But the thing is they're finding these massive search parties and they just find nobody.
And sometimes I get that. Like, the girl one, the missing girl one, like, I can understand. She's going for a big walk in the woods, very easy to get totally lost. But, like, the bus one and the, like, one where she gets lost in a half mile, those both seem so weird.
Yeah.
So weird.
Well, also the missing girl, well, Paula Jean, it's like, there were people behind her.
Yeah, that's weird.
And then they just said, like, they just kind of turn around and then she's just sort of gone.
Ugh.
They don't hear anything.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so creepy.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, that's
all right.
A good one.
Thanks for that.
For sure.
No more hiking in the woods, though, for
no,
a little time for the
gotta
time
stay
being.
Stay out of those woods.
Oh, awesome. All right. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks. Okay, how is that Exorcist cocktail treating you? How
it's
you
not
doing?
Bad. I was busy yapping, so
that's
now
true.
I'm going to kind of sip at it. But
now
I like
to,
it.
Now
yeah.
you get to sit back and relax
yeah.
and have the bright blue exorcism. Awesome. Well, enjoy it. All right. Ready for my story?
I'm ready.
Diving in?
Yep.
Here we go. Okay. The title of my story is The Exorcism of Michael Taylor.
Oh, wait.
Hence, the Exorcist drink. You may know a little bit of this story. It's entirely possible. It was a very famous court case when it took place in the 70s. But
I know. Maybe I'm thinking of the Germany one. But anyway, yes.
This is
I'm
England.
Excited.
This is England.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay,
oh, okay,
so we'll talk about it. So I learned about this story actually.
So many exorcisms.
Yeah. I actually learned about this story, oddly enough, when watching the most recent Conjuring movie, The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It. They make a super brief reference to it in that movie, and I was like, oh, that's interesting, I should look this up, and was fascinated by it. I could do an entire season about the folks Conjuring. In The Conjuring, yeah, sure. And like all of their, you know, weird things that they were involved in and their...
Ooh, maybe that's our spinoff podcast. We talked about this before, doing ones, like horror movies.
You do a lot of those.
I do. Yeah.
Got The Ring, you got Jaws, you got The Exorcist.
I'm into it.
Just those three? Maybe there's another one too. I can't remember. But yeah, those ones you've all done. Anyway, so yeah, so this was mentioned in The Conjuring. The Exorcism of Michael Taylor. So here we go.
All right, I'm ready.
I'll tell you the tale. So, our story takes place in 1974 in the town of Ossett in West Yorkshire.
Sure.
That's right in kind of like right smack dab in the center of the UK. Just right in the middle of it. And we meet there the Taylor family. A group of a family living in Ossett. You've got Michael, the father. He's 31 and a butcher. You've got his wife, Christine, and they have 5 kids.
Wow. At 31?
Well, you know. Yeah.
I don't know why I'm surprised by that.
Yeah. 5 kids. That's a lot. So they're, the Taylors are just kind of a normal family living life in Ossett, doing their things. Except there are 2 things that are, and that kind of, you know, maybe are a tiny bit abnormal. One, Michael seems to suffer from some depression. He gets withdrawn at times.
The father,
yeah, okay. Michael. He gets some depression. He gets withdrawn at times. You know, it's 1974, so obviously he's not, like, diagnosed with anything. Sure. You know, you don't really do that kind of thing in 1974. His wife, Christine, says that, well, he had a back injury, so it's probably that.
I mean...
Maybe, who knows?
Your back hurts all the time.
His back hurts.
And you have 5 kids.
Yeah.
And so you have to butcher things all day.
So he's a little withdrawn.
That'll do it.
Number 2, they are not big church-going people, which actually in Ossett in 1974 is kind of a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's a religious community. The fact that they don't go to church makes them kind of weird.
Back like when your neighbors, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's a little bit weird. So enter into our scene, a woman named Mary Robinson. And Mary Robinson runs a prayer group there in town. And one of Michael's friends, a woman named Barbara Wardman, attends that prayer group. And she, because she is concerned about her friend Michael's poor soul, because he doesn't go to church, she says, you know, Michael, you should come with me. Let's go to this prayer group. And so they do. And the whole family goes and checks out this prayer group.
We're going to fix your back.
Yeah, it's going to be good. And this prayer group is, it's interesting. It's the kind of prayer group that I don't really associate, maybe this is wrong of me, maybe this is my ignorance coming through, but it's not the kind of, like, style of, like, religious prayer group that I associate with England so much as I associate with, like, Southern America. Uh-huh. It's very, like, casting out demons and laying on hands and, like, you know, very much like, you know, the Southern tent style of prayer group, you know?
Right,
which, I never really associate that as much with, like... with, like, the English side as
much as I
do.
But here's the thing. It's the 70s. So I feel like at that point, religions are spreading everywhere. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it might not have originated there. But, I would say, like, in the 70s, that could have easily been, you know.
True.
Gotten popular from something.
Yeah, very
much
so. Yeah. So anyway. So, yeah. So that's the kind of group that we're dealing with here.
All right.
So they start attending this. Marie Robinson's the head of it. Michael, in particular, gets really into it. He's like, ooh, this is it.
He's like, this is what I need.
This is what I need. I've not been going to church, but I have found my church. I found my calling. This is my place to go. And they start becoming very regular attendees at this prayer group. In fact, Michael, in particular, becomes such a regular attendee that he starts having private spiritual meetings. One-on-one private meetings with Marie Robinson, where it is reported that Michael and Marie will sit across from each other for 8 hours at a time and make the sign of the cross in front of the other person in order to, quote, nullify the evil power of the full moon.
For 8 hours?
For 8 hours.
Are you just... over and over again making the sign of the cross, or does it take you 8 hours to like do it once?
I think again and again. I cross you, you cross me. I cross you, you cross me. Nullify the power of the evil power of the full moon.
They're not doing that for 8 hours.
They're doing something.
Right.
So clearly whether it is like, you know, physically consummated or what, there's clearly some sort of like affair relationship.
Yeah.
There's something going
on
between them.
Whether it's an emotional affair.
Yeah, but there's obviously some degree of something going on between them.
I feel like if you're like, I need to sit with somebody for 8 hours and make the sign of the cross, I'd be like, maybe you should outsource that. Yes, yeah. Maybe you should go find somebody else to do that with.
It's a trouble, right? It's concerning. Jeez. So yeah, so that's what's going on. So at one of the weekly meetings, Christine, the wife, she has had enough.
And, yeah, I'll bet.
And at the meeting, she confronts Michael and says, you know,
in front of everybody.
Apparently. Just what? No more 8 hour cross sessions that's, with that woman. I
mean, that feels very fair.
Feels fair. Michael flips out, gets very angry that she's doing this.
Yep.
And in a little, you know, little twist, he turns his anger not to Christine, but to Marie and starts yelling at Marie. And yelling at her. This is just public. This is like in the middle of of one of the like sessions. He's yelling at Marie. Here's Marie's quote about it. This is Marie Robinson speaking later after the fact. She says of this incident, says, quote, "I suddenly glanced at Mike and his whole features changed. He looked almost bestial. He kept looking at me and there was a really wild look in his eyes. I started screaming at him out of fear. I started speaking in tongues. Mike also screamed at me in tongues. I was on the verge of death and I seemed to come to my senses. I knew that only the name of Jesus would save me and I started saying over and over again, Jesus. When Christine heard me calling on the name of Jesus, she started saying it too. And I believe firmly that it was only by calling on his name that I was not killed."
This sounds like two people who have been doing something they shouldn't have been doing, who got called out in front of a big crowd of their neighbors,
yep,
and were like, this is how I'm going to get out
this
of
is the
it.
Plan. Anyway.
I'm just going to start screaming about the devil.
Yeah, and speaking in tongues. So they're yelling Jesus at each other in tongues. It's intense.
Yeah.
That's a week later.
To me. Uh-huh. Okay.
It's the next meeting.
Everyone just goes home.
Yeah, they go home. They're like, hey, did you guys hear what happened at church today? It was kind of intense.
How do you go home with your husband at that point?
I don't know.
I would just be like, are you going to pull it together?
Yeah, I don't know. Things are not good.
Yikes.
So a week later, they go back, and Michael says he has no memory of last week's incident.
Sure,
you know, something came over him. He has no memory.
Yep, that sounds exactly what happened.
Marie addresses it and very publicly exonerates him and forgives him at the meeting. And
now
we're good.
How can you be mad when he doesn't remember?
Yeah.
It wasn't him.
So everything's fine. Christine is, understandably, a little concerned.
Yeah.
She feels like things are going poorly. In addition to all of this, Michael is also getting a little more withdrawn at home, a little more isolated. You know, he's getting angry, things like that. Mm-hmm. So she's concerned. She's not happy about how things are going. So Christine decides that she needs to take Michael and, after he's been forgiven here, take Michael and meet with a local Methodist minister by the name of Reverend Raymond Smith. So Christine and Michael go trot over to Reverend Smith and they say, Reverend Smith, let me tell you what's going on. And they explain it to him.
It's like, we're going to get some voice of reason in here.
Yeah. Reverend Smith very wisely says, you know, I think that he should see a doctor.
Well done, Reverend Smith.
Yes.
The first time.
Yeah. He says, I think that's probably the way to go. Christine says no. She refuses.
Come on.
She will not let him. I don't know. Unclear. She will not let him go see a doctor. So fine. Instead, Reverend Smith calls on, so if he can't see a doctor, Reverend Smith is going to call on another local man of the faith, a guy named Father Peter Vincent. And Father Peter Vincent is the head priest at the St. Thomas's Church in nearby Gawber.
Are they calling him the Catholic priest?
I'm a little bit unclear. I should have checked that. I'm not sure. St. Thomas's Church, that sounds pretty Catholic to me.
Could also possibly be Episcopalian.
That might be the case. Yeah. Anyway. No, because then we deal with like bishops and stuff later. Anyway,
oh,
I'm not
Catholic,
sure.
Yeah.
So yeah. So
he's like, then I'm gonna call him priest.
Yeah. So Father Peter Vincent is like a friend of Reverend Smith and so he calls him. And Father Vincent and Reverend Smith meet with Michael and they, you know, counsel him and they do, you know,
like,
counseling
you,
and all that kind
of
stuff like that.
Doctor.
Yeah, yep. Still no doctor. They say, you know, they meet with him, they talk to him, they do all this stuff. He seems okay, so they send him home, but Christine is still worried. Okay, there we go.
Maybe Christine has, like, had it with...
So that's our setup, okay? So there we go. So now this takes us to the night of October 5th, 1974.
Okay.
October 5th, a Saturday evening, October 5th. Michael is very agitated. Mm-hmm. He is becoming very aggressive at home. He is obsessively counting to himself, up into the, millions.
No.
So there's concern. So Christine takes him back to, this time directly to Father Vincent at his church, St. Thomas's Church, and meets with him there. And Michael, again, they're together, agitated, aggressive, counting, all these things. Father Vincent looks at him and says, you know what? Exorcism. We're doing this. So they decide...
Isn't this in the 70s, though?
Okay, so important to pause right here.
Yeah, isn't it Vatican II time where they have some things set up?
It's important to pause here and acknowledge that it is October 1974. It is 8 months after a little movie called The Exorcist was hugely popular. The Exorcist, the book, is published in 1971. The movie is released in February of 1974. Obviously, you've talked about this on a previous podcast. It was a huge, huge hit.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Maybe people would just have exorcism fever and they're ready to go.
But I thought, when did...
I'm going to have a sip of my Exorcist as we talk about this.
When did Vatican II come out? And I could be so wrong about this. I get it all mixed up in my head. But I thought that one of the things is they were like, okay, listen... If you're going to do an exorcism, you have to do it by the book. We have rules now.
We'll talk a little bit about that more later, but I don't know the full details.
Okay, and one of the rules was you have to be overseen by physicians.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll talk more about that. So, so they decide it's time. We're doing this. Exorcism time.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're right there at St. Thomas's Church in Gawber, and they're going to do it. I'm going to show you a picture. We'll put this on our social media. Look at this. Does this not scream exorcism church?
Oh, yeah.
Totally sure creepy. Look at that place.
Yep.
That's where you're getting your exorcism done.
For sure.
Go check it out, everybody. Creepy Hist on Twitter. And Creepy Hist Pod on Instagram. Go check it out. Okay, so anyway, they're at the church. We're doing this. Now, I read a lot of different articles and stories about this, and there's a little bit of discrepancy in timeline here, so I'm not going to be able to give you a perfectly accurate timeline because not everybody agrees on it. But sometime in the evening of that Saturday, October 5th, they begin this exorcism,
and it lasts right away.
Yeah, they're doing it. We're on. Wow. It's on, and it lasts for a long time.
Yeah, they usually do.
something like 8 hours. It's overseen by Father Vincent and Reverend Smith. Michael is there. Christine is there. A bunch of other members of the prayer group is there.
Sure, you got to get everybody in there.
Yeah, everybody's there.
I was just watching.
Just hanging out.
Bringing food.
I'm unclear if Marie Robinson herself is there.
It is a Saturday.
It's a Saturday. So, what else we have to do? Anyway, it's intense. Michael convulses violently. At one point, they tie him to the floor.
Oh, no.
They take his crucifix that he's brought from home, and they jam it into his mouth. It's all really intense.
Oh, no!
Yeah, it's a lot. Finally, at something like 7 a.m., the priests stop, because it's Reverend Smith and Father Vincent who are doing the exorcism. The two of them stop because they've been doing this for hours.
Yeah.
They are completely exhausted. They cannot go on. And they report that they have successfully cast out 40 demons from Michael. 40 demons from Michael. Now, they do acknowledge that there are 3 demons yet to be cast out, but they just don't have the energy to continue. And so they'll resume.
Why can't you not finish the last 3?
They're too tired. It should be fine. The only 3 that are left are the demon of murder, the demon of insanity, and the demon of violence. Should be fine.
So which ones did you cast out?
The other 40.
It's like the demon of overeating.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not that big of a deal.
Overindulgence. Yeah. So anyway, there we are. So Michael, Michael and Christine are sent home, and
they send her home with the demons of murder.
Only 3, got rid of 40. They send them home. They say, hey, we really think you should contact that doctor now. And Christine says, nope, not going to.
Wow.
Okay. So go home. Reverend Smith, when she gets home, Reverend Smith calls to check on her and say, everything okay?
Would you like to see a doctor?
Yep. Christine says, yep, everything's fine. Michael has taken a sleeping pill. He's asleep. Everything's okay. Thank you for checking. He's asleep. We're good. Pause.
This is not going to go well.
So again, it was like something like 7 a.m. that they stopped and left and went home.
If you take a sleeping pill, do the demons also fall asleep?
The evidence would say no.
Yeah.
Because at 9:45 a.m., the police are driving down a street in the neighborhood there in Osset, and they come across Michael Taylor. He is stumbling through the streets. Oh. He is naked. He is covered in blood.
Oh, no.
And they take him into custody. They go to his house, and they find Christine dead. Before I get into too many details here, I will just advance and give a little spoiler so that it's not too upsetting, just in case. The kids are not there. There's no mention at all of what the kids are up to that night. I can only assume that as things went poorly, Christine had sent them away.
With, like, relatives or something.
Yeah, there's zero mention of so anything related to the kids. The kids are fine. And they get through this. They survive this whole ordeal. So I just want to spoil that right now so you don't get too worried. Anyway, but poor Christine. They go to the house. They find Christine dead. And, like, horrible. Oh. She has been murdered without any sort of murder weapon, just with Michael's bare hands.
Oh my gosh.
He's beaten her to death. Her eyes and her tongue have been removed. And he has, with his bare hands, ripped her face off of her skull.
Stop it.
Yeah. Intense. Really intense.
That sounds like a psychotic episode.
Yeah, it's really bad. He also has killed their pet dog, who he has strangled, ripped the eyes out of the dog's face, torn the limbs off of the dog, and thrown the dog's limbs all over the house.
With his hands?
With his hands. There's blood all over the walls. There's like a dog leg in this room and like a half a dog in this room. It's horrible.
Thank God those kids were not
there. And obviously
in that
they're not
house.
There. Yes. So there you go. So the kids are not there. So this is not good.
That is
it's horrible.
Awful. I have
it's
never
horrible.
Heard this story.
No, it's really terrible. It's really it's very rough. So he is obviously he is arrested.
This is
clearly
it now.
Yeah.
Everyone's out.
Yeah. So he is arrested. He says, again, cannot remember the murder.
Sure.
But he does report that he felt, quote, released. And he says, the evil in her has been destroyed.
Oh, no.
And as he's being interviewed at the police station, as the police are talking to him, he talks about the exorcism, right?
Yeah.
Not a
he
surprise.
He does remember that.
He does remember that. Okay. Here's Michael, here's quote from Michael Taylor talking to the police that next day. He says, quote, it was a long night, referring to the exorcism. It was a long night. They danced around me and burned my cross because that was tainted with the evil. They had me in the church all night. Look at my hands. I was banging on the floor. The power was in me. I couldn't get rid of it, and neither could they. They were too late. I was compelled by a force within me to destroy everything living within the house.
Oh, man.
So he is, of course, as you would expect, charged with murder.
Yeah.
And this becomes a very, very big public court case, as you can imagine.
Oh, that.
The court case starts in March of 1975. Reminder, it was October 74 when the murders happened. So now March of 75, the court case begins. And he pleads not guilty. And Michael's... He takes the stand himself.
Not guilty by reason of insanity?
Yes.
Okay.
He takes the stand himself. Yeah, there's no question that he...
Nobody questions
the fact that
he's
the one who did it.
Yeah.
It's just, you know... Yeah, it's why. So, Michael testifies under oath that he was under control of demons and that Christine also had demons. And that's one of the things that's kind of interesting from a sort of, like, history of law case, is that, like... Part of the argument put forth under oath is that he was the reason he was doing it is because he was under demonic possession. So that's part of like the argument that they're making.
Uh-huh.
He was possessed by a demon, the demons of murder and insanity and violence. And that's like why he committed it. It's not the only time ever that under oath people have, you know, talked about like, you know, have blamed things on demons, but it's not super common
sure.
for this to be an argument that gets made, right?
Well, the I mean, I'm sure a lot of people say it, but like the fact that it gets used in court.
Exactly.
Yeah, because right. usually the lawyer's like, hey, let's try to come up with
But he testifies, else. You know, and he's saying
Right. So I like how he also victim blames her demons.
She's also obsessed. Like, she also has demons.
Her demons were bothering my right. demons.
So that's why he had, well, that's why he had to kill her. Yeah. Because she was under control of demons as well. So the defense does talk about that demon thing, but the defense goes hard against the prayer group and the two priests.
I mean...
Yeah. He calls the group a cult.
Yeah, it's not great.
He calls to the stand the coroner, and the coroner publicly on the stand condemns the ministers and says the minister, it says Reverend Smith and Father Vincent are the ones to blame.
They should not have been doing that.
Yeah. They talk about how at one point they say, well, I'll come to that in a minute. It's really a lot. Here's a direct quote from the defense team. Spoken in court. Ready for this? The lawyer says, I am aware that it is generally regarded as improper for an advocate to express any personal feeling or opinion about the case in which he's engaged. What a British opening that is. I am afraid I find it quite impossible to observe such constraints in this case. Let those who truly are responsible for this killing stand up. We submit that Taylor is a mere cipher. The real guilt lies elsewhere. Religion is the key. Those who have been referred to in evidence, and those clerics in particular, Reverend Smith and Father Vincent, should be with him in spirit now in this building and each day he is incarcerated in Broadmoor, and not least on the day he must endure the bitter reunion with his five motherless children. Ooh. So it is their fault.
Yeah.
And this there's another quote that is saying, like, more focused on the prayer group, saying how, like, they were neurotics feeding the neuroses of this man. And basically the argument that they make is that they implant, all of these people, the prayer group and the priest, they implanted in Michael Taylor this idea that he was possessed by a demon, that he was violent. They sent him home saying, like, you've got the demon of violence and murder in you. And that already he was a psychologically flawed man who then they sort of plant this idea in. And basically the argument is, like, you guys planted the idea of murdering his wife into his brain by doing all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree, because also, like, I mean, he obviously was, like, really struggling mentally. Like, I don't know exactly what was going on with him, but, like, you know, it seemed like whatever first happened in the prayer group caused a real break.
Right.
And then when he was already on that, like, dealing with that break and not recovering from it in any way, this then pushed him. And the fact that, like, he had also been up for God knows how many hours.
Right.
He was probably being physically...
abused,
torture, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, all this, and then...
He just snaps. Know,
mental, and then, yeah, he's completely snapped.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah.
So, yeah, it's not good.
Yeah.
So this is the basic, this is the outline of the case. The verdict ultimately comes in, not guilty by reason of insanity. Damn, not guilty by reason of insanity.
I mean, I don't disagree. It's like, you know, I don't know what was going on with him, but I do. I mean, I don't think he should be, like, running around. He obviously needs a lot of help, but something broke. It was some sort of psychosis.
Right.
To be able to even physically do that.
Yeah, exactly. As I said, it was a very public case, and after after the verdict comes in, interestingly, the public is very much on Michael Taylor's side. Mm. Public is very, they support this not guilty verdict. There becomes a real rallying against exorcisms, and the public really is like, this should never have happened.
Yeah,
they really speak out against it. Reverend Smith, for his part, ultimately does admit that, yes, this was done in error, and we should not have done this.
I mean, you would hope. He's like...
Father Vincent! No. Father Vincent doubles down.
Yeah.
He says, the man had demons in him.
What do you want me to do?
It was needed.
There were three
left. We had to do the exorcism.
I told you which three were left. Yeah,
I was tired.
What do you want me to say?
I couldn't do it anymore. So they did it. Now, the diocese gets involved here, and they, in the immediate aftermath, they suspend all exorcisms, and they say...
Oh, this is the catalyst, then, for that.
Now, I don't know how far it goes, but they do. The diocese at least suspends all exorcisms right there, and they say, and the diocese also sort of condemns Vincent and Smith and says that no one in the diocese is authorized, or was at the time, mm-hmm. to do an exorcism. However, there's this interesting thing, there's this interesting kind of piece in there where some, and Father Vincent certainly falls into this category. I don't know about Reverend Smith as much, but certainly Father Vincent, where some people would, some priests would argue, like, you know, argue like, I don't need to be authorized. This is just part of being, like, doing the, it's doing an exorcism is right. just part of being a priest in the same way that, like, doing communion is, you know, it's just a part of my job description.
Yeah. Well, you don't need to authorize me. For so long it was.
Right. This is me.
I think that's when they finally had to step in and be like, you guys can't just be doing this.
And, you know, and there's a degree to which, if you get yourself in that mindset, there's a degree to which I understand that, because their whole, you know, somebody like Father Vincent is saying, like, I am literally battling Satan here.
Yeah.
I don't need your permission to battle Satan. Like, I'm doing what I'm called by God to do.
To put, like, rules and regulations around it, you almost have to step away from it and sort of admit that it's possible that they're not always, the priest isn't infallible in knowing if it's an exorcism or not. Because I think up until then, they're like, if the priest says it's a demon. And then they're like, maybe not. It's not. Maybe it's someone with schizophrenia. Maybe it's somebody who has, like, you know, an actual physical disorder. Maybe it's just, you know what I mean? It's, there's, like, many things. Because I know, like, now, they still do exorcisms, but it's very rare. And you have to go through a whole battery of, like, psychological, like a ton of people have to sign off on it.
Yes. And in fact, and that leads to the last point here. In October of 75, the diocese that this is all, the whole area is a part of, the bishop puts out a decree saying that you can only do an exorcism with the express approval of me, the bishop.
You must be approved by the bishop. So I knew at some point they put into a thing where it's like, you have to get permission from higher ups in order to do it. You couldn't just go and do it. I thought it was earlier than that.
Well, I don't know about it from a larger level, but at least here, that's where it happens. Yeah. So that's where it ends. Just to kind of wrap everything up here, as for Michael Taylor and what happens to him. So he spends 4 years in treatment, and he is then released.
Ooh, it doesn't seem long enough.
No. He moves back to Ossett.
Oh, I mean, where are you going to go, though, right?
I don't know.
What do you do? Are his kids still there? Like,
yeah,
oh,
I don't know. He moves back to Ossett. He has 4 unsuccessful suicide attempts over the course of his life. In 2005, he is arrested again for sexually harassing an underage girl.
Oh, no.
It's just awful. It's awful. Now I'm kind of doubting myself for a brief moment here, but I'm fairly confident he's still alive. I do believe.
Okay. What's the last name again?
Taylor.
Michael Taylor.
Michael Taylor. I'm fairly confident he's still alive.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's that. One final sort of capper on this whole thing. Here's a great quote to kind of leave it with. One of the main police inspectors involved in the case was a guy named Officer Ian Walker. And he was one of the people who was on the scene at the very beginning and was, you know, heavily involved in it.
That poor guy.
I know. And, you know, in an interview I saw with him after his retirement, he spoke about this. They asked him about it. And here's his quote on this years later after retirement. Officer Ian Walker says, "Of all the incidents in which I was involved in 30 years of police work, nothing affected me like this one. You just bury it and get on with your life as best you can. But before this event, I was agnostic. Now I was an atheist."
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, just awful. So, you know, one of the articles that I read pointed out, and I thought it was, you know, very interesting, that, like, you know, there's all this, you know, at the time there was, you know, all this sort of concern about, like, you know, demons and Satan cults, and, you know, that was a big thing in the 70s, right? But in the end, you know, what caused the church the most trouble was, like, the actions of their own people.
Yeah.
You know, and it was the actions of these guys doing this exorcism that kind of came to bite them the most and caused them the most public support of anything else.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that is the tale of Michael Taylor.
Unbelievable. Great story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Super creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's creepy and sad.
Very sad. Very sad.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's his deal.
All right. Stuff.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Go make yourself an exorcist. Cheers. Exorcism. The drink,
no,
not...
No, it's the drink is...
The exorcist?
The exorcist oh, okay. is the drink.
All right.
You make yourself an exorcist. Do not do
an exorcism.
An exorcist to someone who isn't thinking clearly.
Yeah.
It's a bad way to go.
I think just don't, yeah.
It's a bad choice.
Like, honestly, like, that's the kind of story you think would happen in, like, you know... Like 1815.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
If I was like 1970, yeah. You're like, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bad stuff. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
We will be back in 1 week. We'll see you then.
Bye.